Bring it on, let's go.
Okay.
You can open this as a subcommittee.
Sure.
Tracy can.
Is it a subcommittee or just open up and then hear it as a public hearing?
I open the House Committee on Healthcare today, and we'll open a public, before I open the public hearing, I would like to remind the folks that are in the room that we'd appreciate it if you keep the decorum of the House, which among other things means not cheering or jeering or hollering when anybody's testifying. I want to keep it as neutral as we possibly can, and I also I'd like to ask you to keep conversations down in the back of the room. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2324 and ask Representative Barnhart to
thank you,
join us, and you can bring anybody else up who you want.
Ah, okay.
Or we can just wait.
Please, come ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart, for the record, State Representative from House District 11, Central Lynn and Lynn Counties. Next to me is Michael Bean, who is the Executive Director of Addiction Counseling Education Services, known as Emergence in Eugene and other places. And I think Mr. Ames is coming too, isn't he?
Yes.
We are here on this bill, which is a small fix to the insurance requirements of House of ORS 343A.168. And I'm distributing a legislative council letter on the bill because I understood there was a question about it. What I simply wanted to point out is, and I ought to tell the committee that I am a long-standing, long-term member of the board of Emergence, and so I'm familiar with the kind of issues that come up in addiction treatment, especially in addiction treatment that in which the person of interest or the patient comes to the attention of someone, mostly as a result of interactions with law enforcement. People who go into alcohol treatment often arrive there because they're charged with driving under the influence. And these other two gentlemen will go into more detail. But many of these people have addiction problems that require treatment, and they, under the rules that we have in place, it is possible for them to go to an outpatient program like Emergence to gain treatment. And I think that many of them would benefit greatly if they were able to actually use their insurance. Now, in the last several years, and I don't remember, frankly, when that was, but I'm sure, Mr. Chair, that you do, this statute was changed to allow treatment for these kinds of issues, except in situations in which the person came to the attention of the treatment people as a result of a referral from law enforcement. But the fact is that those referrals happen because of law enforcement in the vast majority of these cases. And so it essentially obviated the value of the rule in the first place. So this amendment, this change in the statute, simply takes one line out of the statute on page 2, line 20, which was a limitation on the mandate. The letter that I distributed from Legislative Council, from Lori Freeman, simply points out that other provisions of the same section of the statute require, and I'm referring now to subsection 3 on page 2, require that the treatment is limited to that that is medically necessary as determined under the policy for other medical conditions. That was a question that we understood the committee was concerned about. Whether it was possible to get treatment that wasn't medically necessary, and it's very clear in this statute that the statute requires that the treatment be medically necessary, and the proposed change makes no change in that requirement, and hence the letter and its contents. And I don't want to go into great detail. I don't want to steal the thunder of Mr. Bean who's been working in these areas for a long time, or of Mr. Ames, and so I'll stop talking and be prepared to answer questions.
Chief, do you want to ask him that question?
No, I think that was the answer to the question.
Is it? Well,
my concern was, talking to some other people, that we distinguish between, in the alcohol end, we distinguish between people who are stupid and have a medical condition. I mean, the guy who drinks after a football game and is unlucky enough to get caught two different times driving home, to me, is not necessarily a medically important situation, and I don't want his insurance paying for something that he should be horsewhipped for. If it's a case of medically diagnosed alcohol dependency, that's a different question. And I think the clarification in my mind is does this separate the medically diagnosed dependency from stupidity?
Thank you.
I can't think of a blunter way to ask that question,
right.
So
Coacher,
I'll do it that
Coacher
way.
Thompson, I think that the statute requires exactly what you're describing, and I can tell you, and Mr. Beam can give you a lot more detail, that one of the things that they do in the screening process is determine whether somebody needs treatment for addiction, and when they need, I'll use the language they use rather than the more colorful language you used, when they need education about when it is appropriate for them to drink and when it's not. And those are very different programs. One of them, as you might imagine, is more expensive and is the one that ought to be covered by insurance. The other one is less expensive, more of an educational process, and they tend to cut these people loose earlier. But I rather than trying to describe all of it myself, I'll leave that detail of that to the expert.
The other issue that's a companion to this is under the change in the DUII rules, we are taking out the education option in a lot of cases. And that makes it even worse because now we've got Mr. Stupid who has a choice between going to jail or going into a medical treatment program that his insurance company is going to pay for. Now I have an even bigger problem because I don't want the insurance company stuck with paying for something that education or jail would have been a better option.
Oh, education is still in there.
You'll have to identify yourself. Give
we'll talk first. About that, but...
Go ahead and give your name and then answer.
My name is Michael Bean. I'm the director of Emergence. And we're required to do ASAM evaluations. And there's an ASAM evaluation 0.25. And then we'd write it up. Even when we called it education, the court says education, or the ADIS, we're required to write it up as an ASAM 0.25, which is education. So now... when they removed education, they come to us. We still write it up as 0.25 education. I would say we've had, you know, probably 300 come to us in the past year, and we have it in Springfield, Eugene, and Albany. 25% of those folks are education, and the insurance companies certainly don't pay. And we let them know that insurance companies aren't going to pay for that.
Do they pay for the evaluation?
Some do. I would say 50% do. The other 50% don't.
Let me stop interrupting you. So why don't I give you a chance to give your testimony, and then we can all ask questions.
What we've seen is that most of our...
Dr. Bernhardt, are you going to stick around?
Are you through? I'm sorry.
Unless there are more questions from the committee, I'll get on to... I'm on the Rules Committee, and they're meeting now, so I'll get on to that unless you have other questions.
No, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I interrupted you twice. So it should be magic.
So we run alcohol and drug programs for alcoholics and addicts, and we also do gambling. And I'm the director, and we get a lot of clients that come into our programs, and we run the education, sort of a 6-week, 12, 18 weeks, depending on what the evaluation is. And the evaluation is based on medical necessity. When... most of our clients are blue-collar working folks, and they come in, and they mostly have insurance. And the problem we've been having is that after we do the evaluation, we're required with all our insurance contracts, and we have a multiple contracts with different insurance companies, we send them a copy of the evaluation report, and then they make a decision whether or not they cover it, how much they cover it, for what period of time they will cover it, and what the reimbursement rate is, which is fine. What we found in the last 2 years is approximately 50% of the insurance companies, it's not a problem. Medical necessity, no worries. And now we're seeing another 50% of insurance companies say it's under a DUII, so we're not responsible and we're not going to pay. So we go, okay, we're going to get paid. Then we tell the client, well, then you're going to have to pay us. And we're pretty low cost, and it makes good economical sense. They have been paying quite a bit. They pay a court fine before they see us. They pay an evaluator fee. And by the time they get to us, they don't have a lot of cash left in their pocket. So we set up these extensive payment plans. But they always, not always, can start on time, the ones who can't access their insurance. So there's a delay in treatment. And a delay in treatment, you have a lower success rate in helping someone recover from alcoholism and addiction. None of these guys who are alcoholics or addicts ever woke up one day and said, I'm going to go to treatment. Where's that telephone? I'm going to get well. There's usually some kind of intervention. And the intervention is by law enforcement, a DUII. It could be a divorce hearing. We get a lot of referrals from DHS over custody hearings with children are getting into trouble. So we're not celebrity rehab. We don't get a lot of folks who come to us saying, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I just want my life to get better, and we wish we did. Nor do we have the budget to run extensive high gloss commercials on TV to attract that. So we get the blue collar working guy. So when we get these folks now, I'm getting calls from their employers. And there's about 70 big employment firms around Springfield, Vida, Blue River, Florence, Eugene, and they want to know why their employees can't access their health care. And I said, you know, and we refer them to their insurance companies. We say that, you know, we quote this part of the law, and they get upset with us. Lots of them have what we call EAP programs, employee assistant programs, who work for all these different employers. Quite often they can call and they do an intervention with the insurance company, and the insurance company will choose to pay. When we get these folks into treatment, then we've got a group, you know, half of them the insurance company are paying, and the other half people are feeling really upset that their insurance isn't paying. So pretty much that's in a nutshell, and we would just like to see some consistency in the route. We like to tell people, you know, if you get a disease, you know, if you contact AIDS out on the street or from a prostitute, the insurance company, you know, you can't pay, but if you get it at home, we'll pay. We consider alcoholism and addiction the same medical necessity disease, whether they pick up the phone at home or the wife brings a husband in or someone gets a DUII. And so we would like to see some fairness there.
Yeah, but you also know, if I can ask a question, there's a difference between alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence, and alcohol.
Absolutely.
And the issue I think that Representative Thompson was raising is if, you know, something like, as I remember, 80% of the young men who abuse alcohol in college ending up not being alcohol dependent and stop abusing when they get out of the fraternity and go home. These, we were trying to differentiate how, even if an insurance company is willing to pay for treatment for alcohol dependence, and this is the trigger that gets somebody into treatment, how do you differentiate between the alcohol abuser or the alcohol stupid, as Representative Thompson says, and somebody who's alcohol dependent? So if you do an ASAM evaluation and it comes out they're just abusing alcohol, they're in a fraternity and they drink a lot during the game, is, do you expect in that case not to be their treatment, not to be covered?
Yes, we don't expect it to be covered. And our contracts with the insurance company says that, you know, when it's a 0.25, you know, we don't. But if it is the other, we do.
There are other questions. Representative Widener.
Do you think this is going to have an effect on everybody's car insurance rates? Because now you're going to basically put a mandate on auto insurance to pick this up, and they spread that across the lines to where it would affect everybody's rates and cause everybody's premiums to go up.
My insurance, car insurance rates go up every year, and
this
I think
isn't
Mr. Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, Representative Reiner for the record. My name is Jonathan Eames. I'm with the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association. This actually is health insurance that it's affecting rather than auto insurance. In fact, this may decrease the auto insurance rates because of kicking drunk drivers off the road, more drunk drivers off the road potentially.
This is only health insurance that already covers substance abuse treatment, right?
Right. That's right.
So it's just, does it cover it under this circumstance or not is the only issue. Okay. Jonathan, do you want to, so we've got our co-speaker of the House with us shortly, so I want to move this along.
I feel the eyes in my back of my head.
Harry, you're the only
Yeah, don't feel rushed.
standing between him getting his
Jonathan.
Do you have anything to add to this?
Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us and hearing testimony on this bill today. I think Mr. Bean actually adequately described the bill and what we're trying to do. This is, you know, if you look at the spirit of the law and the spirit of the statute, it does require health insurance companies to cover chemical and alcohol dependency. And if a lot of people are coming into a program or their only access for DUII is through a court order, you know, they probably should have coverage. They should have coverage to be able to treat their addiction. And oftentimes, as you know, a lot of people, studies show, a lot of people, even if they get, you know, busted on their first time, they've probably done it a number of times and are actually risking themselves and others by being on the road and doing this multiple times. So I've spoken to a number of you about this, so I won't belabor the point. I think this is good. Getting more people and getting coverage for people for treatment is a good thing, and that's the direction we probably want to move in the state. The numbers of people that are treated and should be treated, we're covering about 20% of the folks that should be treated here in the state. And if this provides quicker treatment, so people respond better in their treatment programs because they get treatment quicker, I think that's a good thing. So thank you very much. I know there probably are other people who want to testify on this bill as well. So,
Representative Kennemer?
If I could, just one quick question. You talked about low cost.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered if you could just ballpark.
Well, we're real low cost. We have a board of directors committed to that. Between $600 and $1,200, unless there's some big circumstances, and then it might go up to maybe tops $1,800. And if you know about treatment, that's real.
I do. That's why I ask. And that's very reasonable.
It's not a high-cost affair.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Teresa Hutchinson.
John Powell.
Are you John Powell?
We're not going to take Arnie.
Apparently not.
Okay. We'll be right with you, Representative Robler.
Okay. No, I'll go and test by next door. I have two at the same time. So
oh, okay.
Let me go take that one back first.
Do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, before you representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chair and members, we have concerns about House Bill 2324 that can probably best be expressed by looking at the law that's being repealed here. And it's one sentence that says a screening, interview, and treatment program under ORS 813.021. And if you look at that statute, it's very clear that the court must order this screening and that the court must order the treatment and the court must direct that the person charged pay for it. So this bill would need to adjust those statutes as well. So it's very clear that part of the punitive nature of driving while under the influence and getting under a court order is that the person who's causing the problem pays. And that statute is again, very clear under 813.021. And it simply says, when a court, in accordance with 813.020, requires a person to complete a screening interview and a treatment program, the court shall require the person to do all of the following. Complete the screening interview for the purpose of determining appropriate placement. Pay directly to the agency or organization conducting the screening an interview fee of $150. Complete the treatment program to which the person is referred. And D, pay for the treatment program to which the person is referred. So the law is very clear in this case that this is designed, this $600 or whatever, is to come out of the pocket of the person committing the crime, not shifting that cost off to other members of an insurance plan that are not doing this sort of behavior. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there questions?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah, is that in the bill, that deleted language?
No.
Oh, good. Okay. I thought I was definitely missing something.
No. You just have to look up the citation.
Yes.
That's deleted.
Perfect. Now it's clear. Thank you very much.
Could we infer from that if your client pays for one of these services, that your client is in violation of the law?
Mr. Co-Chair, members, it would appear as if at least the law is not fully understood.
That's nicely edged.
Because
nice job.
You do, in fact, well, ignorance is no excuse, as I'm sure you know, but you do know that your insurance companies do pay for this under many circumstances.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not aware of the fact they even know that it's court ordered in some cases.
Yeah. That's possible.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder if, you know, part of the problem is that many times it is medically necessary. And I suspect that overrides the court situation because it's not the DUI, it's the problem that the person has.
And Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Kinnemer, there are also other forms of treatment programs that the court and the screening process can send these people to, that county programs as opposed to necessarily just private programs as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, please introduce yourself.
My name, Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Therese Hutchinson and I'm an addiction treatment specialist for the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'm here to testify and provide information regarding House Bill 2324. House Bill 2324 provides the opportunity for reimbursement for addiction treatment specific to individuals with private group health insurance benefits diagnosed with a substance use disorder and referred as a result of a DUI conviction. Medically necessary addiction treatment for those with a diagnosis may be reimbursed by private group health insurers regardless of the referral source. In 2007, alcohol use was responsible for 1,400 deaths and 80% of all chronic liver disease deaths in Oregon. Our treatment data shows us that approximately 273 adults need addiction treatment, yet only 48,000 are served in our public system. In calendar year 2009, approximately 14,000 individuals convicted of a DUII paid out of pocket for treatment related to their conviction. 1,435 individuals reported an access to private health insurance benefits. Some individuals are eligible for a sliding fee scale using public-supported treatment. Addictions and Mental Health Oregon Health Authority receives a number of calls from publicly supported providers requesting guidance because their private health insurers refuse to pay for treatment for their members with a substance use diagnosis if treatment is required by a court order. If individuals are able to access addiction treatment as part of their health care benefit, they may not need to rely on publicly supported treatment system. A DUI represents a window of opportunity for people in crisis to address their use of substance. Even though a majority of people are coerced into treatment, we observe good outcomes in Oregon. Information from Oregon's addiction treatment follow-up study indicates 6 months after treatment, 89% of participants are abstinent from drugs and 76% from alcohol. Our data shows us a 79% treatment completion rate for people who are referred under a DUI diversion or conviction and less than a 10% recidivism rate. Addiction is a chronic but treatable disease. House Bill 2324 provides individuals with the opportunity to use their health care benefit to access addiction treatment when they need it, regardless of the reason they are seeking help. Also allows the state to prioritize the use of public funds to serve individuals without health care benefits or means to pay. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify and provide information regarding this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions?
You referenced private group health insurance. Does the Oregon Health Plan cover this?
Chair Greenleg, Chair Thompson, members of the committee. Chair Thompson, the Oregon Health Plan, with medically necessary a substance use diagnosis, will cover alcohol and alcohol treatment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I must not have been listening carefully enough. I'm not really clear on what you're saying. You're saying that it is in the public interest to see that people that need treatment get it, and therefore it's appropriate to make sure it's reimbursed. Is that the line you're following? I'm sorry, I don't quite understand why the health authority is here testifying.
Chair Greenleck and Chair Thompson and Representative Kenmer, I'm here to provide information regarding the House bill, and the Oregon Health Authority's position is neutral. My purpose is to provide information about the bill.
Supervisor Wagner?
Thank you, Chair Greenleck. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say success rate through the treatment program was 89%?
Chair Greenleg and Chair Thompson, members of the committee, and Representative Widener, what I indicated was that information from our Oregon's addiction treatment follow-up study indicates 6 months after treatment that 89% of the participants are abstinent from drugs and 76% from alcohol. And then our data shows our client process monitoring system data shows us that 79% complete treatment when they're referred under a DUI diversion or conviction.
Those numbers are for people that have completed treatment, I think.
Right. So 6 months after people complete treatment, there was a study completed by Addictions and Mental Health and the Oregon Health Authority, and 89% of those participants said that they were abstinent from drugs, and 76% said they were not using alcohol.
May I follow up?
Yeah.
Because those numbers sound very high to me.
Sound high to me, too.
Was there some sort of punishment for them if they said that, no, I have been drinking? Is there incentive for them to lie to you?
This was a study that was completed by Oregon Substance, a six-month report in December of 2010. And I don't have all the specifics of the report, but I could gather information and bring it back to the committee if you'd like to know more information.
I would be curious on that.
Self-report. This is a six-month self-report.
It's a self-report.
For people who have completed the program, not people who didn't. And it's a self-report absent at the time. It's
right.
Not whether they've used things in between. It's at that moment.
Right.
I was worried. I thought my district might have been pulling the average down.
Thank you. Can you clarify that one step further for me? Is that number in the folks in that report folks that the Oregon Health Authority paid for, or is that public and private insurers combined and people who got treatment from either or? And second kind of piece of that question then is, what do you feel like, I know it's your agency you represent it, is there a difference in the, or do you have data on the success rate of folks going through OHA providers versus going through private providers, just overall? Is there a discrepancy or difference quality piece that would tie to that potentially?
Chair Greenlicht, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, and Representative Parrish. As far as the split out in terms of the participants, I would again have to bring the report to the committee, and so the members would be able to read that. I don't have those specifics.
OHA doesn't have any treatment programs.
Pay for them.
Right.
You mean Medicaid? Is that
Your
health plan?
The health authority does. We do pay for. You just said in a previous statement that some of these folks would qualify for
publicly funded programs, and so that
managed
money
through the Oregon Health Authority, right? That's who does
right,
that.
The money would go from the state to the counties, who then would work with
right.
the providers. As far as the, I would have to bring back data for that. I don't have that right now with me.
Okay. Me, for the clarifier, that's a statement. The Oregon Health Authority, with one set of its funds, provides funds to the various counties, and the counties then mm-hmm. fund services somewhere. But the health authority doesn't manage any services or provide any services, is that right?
They contract for services.
Well, they give money to the counties.
Right, right.
They don't contract for services. In fact, we had a bill in to try and allow them to contract for services, and we weren't able to get that through.
Okay.
It would be useful to get that data. We would appreciate it.
Yes, and I will make sure that you get that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we are ready to close the public hearing on House Bill 2324. And what do we have now? 2635?
Yes. Representative Baldwin should be here shortly.
Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2635. Did you tell us what that bill is about? And perhaps you could check in the next door and see whether Representative Roblin is ready to go.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2635 provides that a person may not administer an immunization against hepatitis B to a child under 10 years of age unless that person has provided the parent or guardian with the vaccine package insert that contains the information on the risks of the immunization, and the parent or guardian has consented in writing to immunize the child. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
And can we stand at ease for just a moment? Is it?
There he is.
Tracy Kidd, will you
yep.
enjoy it?
Hi,
nice to meet you. Good. Thank you. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Greenlick. I, for the record, I'm Arnie Roblin, State Representative, Co-Chair, Co-Speaker of the House from District 9, and I am really pleased to be here today to talk about an issue which is important, and I want to explain a little bit today about how we came to be here today. I have had a longstanding belief that part of the job as a representative is to represent your community and the people in it, and if they have ideas that they believe strongly in, that I have an obligation to listen and to give them insights in what I think, and then if they meet all of those criteria that I set in front of them, to help them come here and present those ideas to us to get a vetting in it at the state level. I am a person who believes strongly, and I think you'll hear from Ms. Kidd the same, that vaccinations are very, very important. They have changed the world. I have my youngest child, when she was about 2 months old, ended up having whooping cough. And it's a disease which we've pretty much eradicated, but continues to come back from time to time. That experience taught me one thing. You need to vaccinate your children against those diseases. The fact that our doctors told us that the survival rate seems to be the same now as it was 50 years ago if you get whooping cough. It's a difficult disease. And we spent many a sleepless night patting our child on the back to remove stuff and having that cough. And we had doctors that said, I don't think she really has whooping cough until they heard her in the hospital. And they said, wow, that's whooping cough. And we said, yeah, that's whooping cough. So those diseases still happen. We had a recent case of a measles person coming from overseas. And we know how important it is to get vaccinated. So this is not about vaccines or a problem. Vaccines are saving a lot of people's lives. So the issue is, and what I had asked when we first met, explained to me the issue, and she did, and I said, well, get me some more research before I'm going to go forward, because the concern was that in this particular case, maybe having the vaccine at this age was not the appropriate time. Maybe it should be at 10 years old, because here's the reasons. And she brought a lot of books, a lot of information. I again asked, let's talk about this and think about it. A third time she came back to explain. We actually got to meet her grandson, and they're not indicating to me ever that it's a definite relationship between this and the son. It's just there was a, you'll get to hear more about that particular situation. The issue, as she investigated and told to me, was, are we making the correct decision on this particular vaccine at this particular age? And is there evidence? And I said that the best way to do that is to have a hearing and let people who have spent a lifetime and now are committed to this particular committee look at the evidence, look at the information, and move forward and make a decision. So I am honored to have one of my constituents come here today to give you information that she's been studying for a long time. And then you can ask all the questions you need, and I feel pretty confident we'll be able to answer them to the best of her ability. We can look forward and see if this is something that we need to look at in the state of Oregon. So, again, I want to thank you for your consideration and your ability to take this, and I would answer any questions that you might have for me.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the speaker?
Obviously a very clear job.
Thank you. Clear, at least to this point. And I anticipate that you're going to hear some great testimony and we'll probably have some questions. And I want to say that in our conversations, we're very open to amendments. They may believe that amendments need to happen at now, even now, from their own perspective. So this is not about, this isn't the finished product. We would love to have any indications from you as to how things could be made better.
Absolutely.
So, well, thank you, and I'll leave that to Ms. Gibb.
Thank you. I do have one problem, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself.
I do not know how to turn this on.
we'll take care of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought a principal could do that.
Mr. Chairman, co-members of the committee, and everyone else that's interested in this, my name is Tracy Kidd, and I come from Coos Bay, Oregon. And I have a grandson that was injured, and I'll tell you more about my story. One of the things that I need to address before I start today is that the bill is inaccurately worded, and there is a misconception, and I've found that from some of the letters that we've received from doctors and physicians and maybe even some from yourself. It is my intent with this bill to stop the hepatitis B vaccine from being administered to anyone under the age of 10, unless the child has a hepatitis B or tests positive for hepatitis B. When the vaccine is administered to anyone at any time, the manufacturer's insert must be given to the patient or the parent so that we can refer to that if we have an issue. Okay, so, and this is already being worked on.
I'm a little worried about making sure your voice is picked up for the reading.
Oh, should I change it?
I think so.
Okay, before you, I've placed a whole lot of literature and also the testimony that I'm giving today. And the reason that I did that is because sometimes even physicians, and by the way, they're not at fault for what's going on here, nor are they responsible. Basic bottom line is they do not get educated to the degree that they should be because they don't have the time in their studies to get that far. Okay? So, I'd like to begin. I am the grandmother to Zachary Cox. He was born happy and healthy.
Why don't you be seated unless there's a reason not to.
Okay. And sorry about that.
Thank you.
I'll start over. I am the grandmother to Zachary Cox, and he was born happy and healthy to Kyle and Sarah Cox on November 7th, 2009. On November 8, at approximately 12 p.m., Zachary was injected in the leg muscle with the hepatitis B vaccine. The nurse instructed us the vaccine was required by law and wanted us to sign a release to allow the administration of the vaccination. We naturally asked questions and were informed that the vaccination was safe and that it was required. After they administered the vaccine, Zachary was required to stay in the hospital 6 hours. They released mommy and baby approximately 6 p.m. that night. The baby went home with no signs recognizable. The home health nurse from the mom's program came over at 8 a.m. the next morning, November 9th. While she was examining Zachary, he started turning blue from his feet to his arms and then to his mouth. She said that she had seen this before with other babies, although those parents did not take their babies in. We did take Zachary to the doctor, then to the local hospital where Zachary was admitted. The first thing they asked us was, did you shake the baby or drop the baby? We informed them that the home health nurse was there when this happened, and no, we did not. He was suffering from seizures and breathing apnea. We continued to stimulate him to get him to breathe, and even the nurses attending to Zachary were having a hard time knowing what to do. Zachary was laying down, and they were stimulating him by jiggling his chest and kind of shaking him. I went and grabbed a cold wash rag and placed it on Zachary's forehead as he reared up and started to breathe. And that is how we made him breathe prior to his hospitalization. But as with any case, when you are facing a life and death situation, as we were, you start to do things that to just keep them alive. The doctor arrived and decided that we needed to take blood from Zachary's spinal fluid and perform other tests to see what was happening. When the doctor came back, he said Zachary was in critical condition and that they had found blood in his spinal fluid and in his brain, and that they needed to take him to Sacred Heart Medical Center. Because of weather and time, we could not get a helicopter to North Bend fast enough, and they transported Zachary from ambulance to Eugene. Zachary was examined by Sacred Heart Neurology Team, and they recommended that we go to Dornbecker's Children's Hospital immediately. And they said Dornbecker's was more equipped to handle Zachary's case, as they had four other cases similar to Zachary's. Prognosis of Zachary's was serious. We did what we could until they released us from the hospital. The trauma that our family suffered was beyond explanation, and Mommy and Daddy cried and just tried to be strong through it all. Okay, and I've given you some literature here, and I'm sorry. Let's see here.
Is that in the material you passed it out?
Excuse me?
Is that in the material you passed
out? I've passed it out to all of you, yes. Yeah, and there are some.
Good, then. Because we're not going to be able to read that.
That's fine. Hepatitis B. What is hepatitis B? Hepatitis B is a viral infection. Symptoms may be similar to the flu, including weakness, loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, and a low-grade fever. Diarrhea, sore muscles, and joint pain. A swollen liver and jaundice, yellowing of the skin and eyes, are possible as well. In some instances, individuals who contract this disease are carriers of the virus, yet exhibit few or none of these symptoms. Acute hepatitis B usually runs its course within a few months. Most patients do not require hospital care, and 95% of them recover completely. They will not contract the disease again. Long-term or chronic hepatitis B infections can be very serious. Authorities estimate that 20% of the chronic cases eventually progress to liver damage, causing about 4,500 deaths annually. How is hepatitis B contracted? In the United States, about half of the new cases among adults occurs through sexual transmission. The virus is spread through contact with the body fluids, blood, saliva, and semen of the infected person. The virus remains communicable outside of the body for at least 1 week.
Ms. Kidd, I'm not sure what the value of reading this to us is.
Okay, and I agree, because we can definitely get past this. You've definitely got the information in front of you, and going through it is probably mundane at this point. But to be honest, the vaccine itself basically was administered to Zachary at 2 days old. And then 16 hours after the vaccine hit his system, he stroked, okay? And then he had breathing apnea, and he was having seizures. When we got to the hospital and went through the process, at 4 months, we went and saw the neurologist here at Dornbecker's Hospital, and he completely ruled out every aspect of Zachary. It was not a birth defect. It was not a genetic defect. It wasn't from stress through the pregnancy or any other cause. They had no cause. We discussed the fact that it was that we felt that it had to do with that vaccine. seeing as how the vaccine was administered 16 hours before. He said more likely than not. And that's the closest we've come to anybody agreeing or having, you know, any opinion or even discussion regarding Zachary's case, okay? But when I got into my research, I started looking into my research to see if I could fix Zachary, okay? And that's what you do as a grandma, is you try to go in and you try to see what we can do to make it better, okay, and make his prognosis better, or see if we, you know, like physical therapy, things like that. However, in February of 2010, an article came through our paper about a shaken baby syndrome case down in Medford. And I don't know the outcome of that case. I do know, because I had contact with the public defender, that the baby was up to date with his vaccines. The second vaccine is administered on the second month, okay? The same exact vaccine that they give a 19-year-old is administered to an infant. And basically, that baby had the vaccine within a week, because the baby was 9 weeks old, probably went to the doctor with it on its two-month checkup, and was also had a reaction with bleeding in the brain, and I'm not sure of what other symptoms the baby had. And it really didn't concern me as to whether the baby was shaken or not. What alerted me at that point was the fact that I remembered, you know, the words that were said to us in that hospital. Did you shake the baby? Did you drop the baby? Which is standard protocol, obviously, for those that are unaware of the fact that it does appear that the baby's been, you know, had some trauma. I mean, and most of the time, we're not looking at the fact that the baby's had the vaccine within hours, days, or what have you. So standard protocol is, as physicians and medical, they call in help from CPS and from, you know, the police department to investigate the situation. However, in our circumstance, I know that we didn't, okay? We didn't have anything like that go on. And in most circumstances, mommies and daddies are just trying to, you know, do whatever they can do for their babies. 99% of us do that, okay, you know, as a routine. However, these kids are being accused of shaken baby syndrome, and when I got to looking into it, my research changed. That day I saw that article, I started researching how many kids are actually being accused of shaken baby syndrome for the same dang thing that we had happen to us, okay? And it was appalling. I could not believe it. So I then started taking a look back at my family. I have five children, the oldest being 25, which is the father to Zachary. And with my older children, my youngest is 10, okay? With my older children, they received the vaccine at 10, okay? And I'm not against the vaccine by no means, okay? And I went that very clearly understood. I agree with whatever we need to do to protect the future of the population of the United States. However, in the state of Oregon, and because I live in the state of Oregon, and I have a lot of contact with a lot of kids, and all I could think of was the fact that that little girl is going to have a baby soon, and they're going to vaccinate that little girl's baby, and that one, and that one, and that one, and all of these kids. I've been I do community service, so I spend a lot of time with the high school kids, okay, and I mean a lot of time, and all the way down to my youngest daughter's age. I'm in that school, you know, and I mean I do a lot with the children. I could not picture myself standing by and not bringing it to the attention of our state to take a look at what I'm trying to say. That vaccine is transmitted through blood, saliva, and intravenous drug users. The one thing about the saliva part is it's kind of misleading, because it's not contacted through a kiss or off of a cup. It has to be saliva with blood. In other words, what I found in my research, you have to bite somebody, literally bite somebody, and have blood in your teeth to contact the blood of that person that you bit in order for it to come through saliva, okay?
Kid, where are we going with this?
The bottom line is our babies aren't participating in sexual, you know, obviously they're not being sexual, and they're not participating in drug use. And especially, I picked the age of 10 because my older kids got it at that age, and they were fine, and they were capable of telling us that they had a headache or what have you. But the bottom line is, if they're not participating in till that age or beyond, why are we giving it to the infant? That's my question. And that's the question I pose to you. You're physicians, and I know that I obviously did the research and have spent 14 months looking into the situation. And in all the literature, and I went through mega, mega amounts of literature, I have yet to find the answer why we're giving it to an infant and to a system that has not even developed, you know, to be able to handle a vaccine that a 19-year-old, the same dose as a 19-year-old receives at 180 pounds, that infant's getting the same exact dose. And I want to know the answer to that. And that's why I'm before you.
Any questions? Representative Thompson?
First of all, I have to congratulate you for this. I have never, ever seen testimony brought to us that is anywhere near this large or complete. So obviously you put a lot of work into this.
Yes, I did.
And I appreciate the care. A question beyond what you've testified, you're asking that the parents, guardians be given the product insert?
Absolutely, I am.
What are we looking for? I mean, I have the product inserts here for several of these products.
And I've got a product insert here, too.
What is it that the parent is supposed to get out of this?
Okay, well, the product insert is about this big, actual size. And the main reason that I feel that if we would have received that insert, we may not have read it, and 95% of the people aren't going to read it, okay? But when that insert gets placed into the fingertips of an 18, 19, 20-year-old, those having babies that are young, and it's placed into the fingertips of that person, that impact and that nurse saying, if you have any reaction to this hepatitis B, please contact your doctor. Well, we may not read that, but after we've had a stroke and somebody's put it into our hands and said, if you have a reaction, please report that to your doctor, that reminder and just the initial fact that they had it in their fingertips and we've touched it, we can refer back to that in 16 hours later and know what we're facing. And I don't know what inside this insert, in all honesty, and I've read it, and I've read several different manufacturers' inserts, scares the physicians or CDC or any other entity away from us from having to want us not to see it. I don't see any content in here that is so frightening or even more frightening than anything that we're seeing in the minute and a half of advertisements on TVs. Okay? I mean, we're not ignorant. Obviously, we know that these vaccines save our babies. Okay? Period. And this little content right here, it may not matter at all when it's given to us at the hospital, but with the words, if you have a reaction, please call your physician, that matters, okay? And it would have mattered very much so in the case of Zachary, okay? That's my opinion. And that's my opinion because most of the time when we have a vaccine, not even the physicians are trained to look at the literature or look at the documents and the baby's vaccine or that they've had the vaccine after a reaction such as bleeding behind the eyes or bleeding in the brain such as in Zachary's case, nobody even addressed the vaccine. We went on for nearly 3 weeks not even knowing that the vaccine was what it was that affected him or what we suspected or what was confirmed by the neurologist, more likely than not. Okay, and we may have known that if this little tiny stupid piece of paper that means very little to some of those that are getting that shot was given to us at that point. That's my reason behind it.
I don't want to belabor this, but I've got an insert here, and I'm still not sure what that point is because the adverse reactions here are is a discussion of statistics on some test patients, but it says, however, these reactions, although rare, have been reported following injection in humans. Okay, this is all adverse events were mild in intensity. There were no serious adverse events.
Okay, and
that's not exactly what I think you want to tell.
I can testify completely, totally away from what those documents state.
Oh, no, I'm not questioning you know? What happened.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
questioning
I'm
whether this is
Zachary.
What you want to do or not.
Yes, it
I'm,
is.
I'm,
It is what I want to do. I want that insert, like you do when you go down to the pharmacy and they disclose the contents of that, you know, medication or whatever from the pharmacy. You get a copy of whatever is in that, what the side effects are, what the possibilities are, and you're, by federal law, and that's why the pharmacies do that, they hand that to you for your protection, okay? But as an infant and as young parents, we're not getting that, okay? We get none of that on a vaccine that can have side effects that can be deadly, okay? Not just stroke-wise, seizure-wise, or the things that we face, but we could have lost Zachary, and we nearly did, okay? And it's my job as Zachary's grandmother to make sure that I educated myself, in which I have fully educated myself and obviously given you the documentation to back up everything that I said, okay? And I did research on the vaccine manual that I also have provided for you. The vaccine manual has everything in it that's in my content, okay? And I did not only give you what that manual said, I researched every aspect of what that manual said and what I provided to you so that you would, and I confirmed it, okay, because I wanted to know that. I wanted to know that that was accurate. Even though it's a manual, I still wanted to know that.
I think
that.
You answered his question.
Yeah. I think I understand that you want people to be aware of the warnings if they're warranted, and I'm sure we heard the testimony on that. I'm just not sure this is the vehicle. I mean, I have the inserts from four products. The one in original form is 24 inches long. Mm-hmm. So it's a big, long piece of paper in fine print, and these others converted to Word are 7 pages, 12 pages, and 15 pages. And there's nothing in here that addresses Zachary.
Okay, and
I can see in these.
And that's not what I was after with that insert, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, when I came here and I went to Arnie Roblin, I told Arnie Roblin that I wanted the bill mainly to address the fact that we want to stop the vaccines from being administered to an infant, which is not the content of the bill that you guys were provided with.
Okay.
It's to stop the, you know, vaccine, period, from being administered to anyone
that's
outside of hepatitis B
positive. That's not what the bill says, is it?
No.
Yeah.
And the insert that you've received and the documentation, it actually comes in, like, you know, the little tiny little insert that comes in with every vaccine that's given at the hospital. You get that provided with the manufacturer, has to send that to the hospital. So you're right. This kind of documentation, and if we had to come up with it and go through the administrative process of acquiring it, I agree. It would be a lot of paperwork and unnecessary. But when it comes with the vaccine itself, then we aren't really doing anything extra except for taking it out of the box and putting it into the hands of the family that received it. And it isn't so much about the content, or granted, I cannot, and I honestly cannot prove these strokes and things like that, except for by thousands and thousands of documentation and people fighting the same thing.
I think you answered. Yeah. Let's hold the answer to the question.
Just going through here, I'm kind of with Representative Thompson. I mean, there's tons of information on this, on when they should get, because I'm trying to figure out why we're doing infants. And it says during birth, when a virus passes from an infected mother to her baby, that could be why they're doing it to an infant when they're there, but I would think they'd already have it, so it's not making a lot of sense to me. But I think this is something that goes way beyond this bill and needs to be addressed.
We may get some more testimony.
We've got
several people waiting to testify this.
And you're right, the baby, when we are saving that baby because he's already got it when he comes out.
Yeah. So
the other thing,
anyway,
and very most important thing that I'd like to show you, and this is the statistics in Oregon, if I can, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
We do need to move on. So
I know, and I just want to show you this one very, very important factor. I don't know how to turn this. I'm sorry.
You're on.
Okay. In Oregon, from the year 2001 to 2010. We had one case reported of positive hepatitis B in an infant under the age of 4. Under the age of 14, we only had one incident reported in the whole state of Oregon. So two cases under the age of 14. Clearly, that states to me that no one under the age of 10 is getting it. I mean, it might happen after the age of 10.
Wouldn't those people all have been vaccinated?
All of these, no, they have not been vaccinated. These are babies, and even if they have been vaccinated, and I'm not sure if they have, because really that didn't start until 2003. So the data here is prior to that as well as after. And actually, the data that I do provide to you comes from 1988, and there's only one case reported from 1988 to 2010, okay, on an infant. Okay, so only one hepatitis positive case in the whole state.
The bill we have in front of us isn't about outlawing.
What's that?
I see the bill we have in front of us is not about outlawing the vaccine. The bill.
Now, I don't want to outlaw the vaccine anyway. I just want to prolong it till the age of 10. And my bill is not accurate.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're
we have
welcome,
a few
sir.
Other folks.
Thank you for the time
to
testify. I appreciate it very much.
Can we call Jane Ann Nussbaum?
Excuse me. Did I need to? And I'm not sure. And I'm sorry. This is new to me. I have my son here, and he'd like to testify. And I also have someone from Coos Bay that is facing the shaken baby syndrome case that I'd like to testify. We can wait until later if need be. And I apologize.
Well,
that
if
I
you
didn't
go briefly,
protocol.
Let's go now. Introduce yourself, please.
My name's Kyle Cox. I'm the father of Zachary Cox, who had the hepatitis B injection right after birth. He suffered a stroke 16 hours after he had the vaccine, and he was a perfectly healthy baby at birth, normal birth. It was a very horrible thing to go through, new parents and having to go through the trauma of knowing whether your baby is going to live or die. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And to be something to be a product of a vaccine is, I'm not hepatitis B positive. My wife isn't. No one in our immediate family is hepatitis B positive. I don't know how my baby could get hepatitis B at this age. He's not going to have any contact with anybody that has hepatitis B. So for an unnecessary vaccine to be given to my son that would almost cause his death, it really upsets me. And I could have, I mean, that it's horrible to go through something like that. And I would like this to stop from anybody else have to go through that. And being at the age of 10, our bodies can hardly handle that kind of vaccine. But at least at the age of 10, they can relate their symptoms, and they could say, hey, you know, we almost went to bed, and my son, we would have not caught that. But gut feeling told us to go in and have him monitored through the night. And no later than 30 minutes after we got to the hospital, he started having more reactions and breathing apnea. And we were almost in bed. And if we would have gone to bed, we would have woke up in the morning and our baby wouldn't be here. And they would have called it SIDS. And that would have been the end of the story, you know. And I wouldn't want anybody else to go through that. And who knows, all these cases of SIDS, that could have been caused from a vaccine. It may not have been, but it could have been. If we could have delayed these vaccines until a later age when maybe their body's more able to handle that, it might have been able to save a lot of kids. And we turned out very fortunate in this situation, and my son is doing very well now. But he is a rare case that is doing well after a stroke like that. He had a hot dog-sized bleed in his brain, and he recovered fully so far. Not to say that he won't have any problems down the road. Nobody can tell that. But as of right now, he's doing really well. And most of the time, it doesn't end up like that. So we're very fortunate. And I don't want this to happen to anybody else. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And that's mostly what I have to say.
Thank you very much. It was obviously a very difficult experience.
Yeah, it was very hard.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Brandy Grimes, and unfortunately, I am another case, except my fiancé and I were not fortunate enough to have a medical expert standing there when our baby had a seizure. So we have had to go through the CPS shaken baby syndrome accusations for the last 13 months or so. In which we have been separated, we have been interrogated, we have gone through countless court hearings, and to this day, if you look into my son's medical records, it is still unknown to why he had two subdural hematomas and bilateral retinal hemorrhages. Nobody can really say why. To be honest with you, I'm not even sure if we can necessarily pinpoint it, but this vaccine seems to be the most logical answer, because my son Mickey happened to have his 2-month booster shots 4 days before he started having seizure activity. So, you know, it's just like they were saying, it just doesn't make much sense why two young parents that have never been exposed to hepatitis B would even begin to need the vaccine for their child as soon as it comes out. So that's all I really have to say.
Thank you very much.
Can I add to that? There are 3 other cases,
yes,
exactly like hers, with no signs of abuse. There's no bruising. There's no, not even whiplash on these babies, okay? And they're all going through the system. It's cost them $8,000, hers.
Yeah.
And there's 3 other cases that are new down there.
We
good, thank you. Day. Thank you. You've had
sorry.
Yeah, a pretty good run.
Thank you. Thank you for
thank
your time.
You. Thank you both.
Thanks a lot.
Can I call? Yes, I can. Can I call Jane Ann Nussbaum, Michael Gilbert, and James Lace?
And Mr. Co-Chair, I believe you got electronically Jane Ann Nussbaum's testimony as Dr. Gilbert, I believe.
We have them on the record, is that what you're saying?
Yes, you should have it electronically, and I think they'll be passing out hard copies as well.
Good, thank you. Go for it.
Go ahead. Okay.
Whoever.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to speak today, Honorable Mitch Greenlick, Honorable Jim Thompson, and the Healthcare Committee. My name is Jay Ann Nussbaum. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to oppose HB 2635. I am speaking from the perspective of a parent, a nurse, and a liver transplant coordinator. The consequences of having hepatitis B are numerous. My first child was found to have chronic hepatitis B. Initially, she was selected for adoption by another American family. But when they found out she was infected with hepatitis B, this weighed heavily in their decision not to adopt. This is a tragic outcome, and in this case, it was my good fortune to have the opportunity. Other families of hepatitis B children found that they experienced social isolation if the disease became known, and there were very few play dates. This also is a tragic outcome. And this disease can cause social isolation, but it can be prevented if parents choose to give the vaccine. As a transplant coordinator at OHSU, I work with patients who are waiting for liver transplant due to end-stage liver disease, cirrhosis, and liver cancer, of which some are attributed to hepatitis B. 90% of infants and 30% to 50% of young children who do become infected with hepatitis B virus go on to develop chronic infections. 1 out of every 4 adults who is infected during childhood die from hepatitis B-related disease later in life. That's from the WHO fact sheet 2008. We have given liver transplants to a number of patients who have hepatitis B-related disease. These were the lucky ones, the ones that were diagnosed and considered eligible to be triaged for liver transplant. But there are many more that go undiagnosed and untreated and by then are not considered liver transplant candidates, but still require expensive, ongoing medical care. This costly medical care can be prevented by a simple vaccine if it is chosen to be given, and could also save the country the social and financial responsibility for the expensive care of end-stage liver disease and liver cancer. A few years ago, I adopted 3 children from Kazakhstan around the ages of 6 and 7. Not all at once. But with each child, I had to evaluate the need for giving the vaccines or repeating immunizations against the risk due to the possibility that their health records were not accurate. So in some cases, I repeated vaccines. In other cases, I did not. But at that time, I was given the vaccine information statement provided by my physician for the immunizations. The idea, this was very complete, accurate, and to the point summary of the risks of getting the immunization. The idea of being presented with lengthy and technical manufacturer's insert to read at that time would have been very impractical, and I would not have been able to digest or interpret any of it, even with my nursing education background, having a master's in science of nursing. As a nurse, I have also been involved in developing patient education materials. At Oregon Health Sciences University, the nursing administration has confirmed with me that the standard is to write patient education materials at a fifth or sixth grade reading level, or even lower. The package insert is written far above this level. Literacy involves decoding, fluency, and many other factors. Anxiety decreases comprehension, and this occurs when health decisions need to be made. If the goal is to help eradicate the impact of this virus, then the goal should also be to make the immunization easy and accessible without undue burden to the general public, not create fear and uncertainty in parents with the potential of not using this very valuable and life-saving vaccine. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick, Chairman Thompson, thank you, and the rest of the committee, thank you. My name is Dr. Michael Gilbert. I'm a pediatric infectious disease physician at the Legacy Health System Children's Hospital in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to urge you to reject House Bill 2635, and incidentally, I also do not support the avoidance of the birth dose of hepatitis B vaccine. It's a little confusion as to what this bill is all about to me, but as which was given to me, the measure that provides that persons may administer immunizations against hepatitis B to child under age 10 unless that person has a parent or legal guardian is given a vaccine package insert. This is what I am speaking to. Hepatitis B is a contagious liver disease that results from infection with the hepatitis B virus. It can either be acute or chronic, the latter of which can lead to lifelong liver disease and even death. It's spread when body fluids from an infected individual are passed to an uninfected individual. This can happen through sexual intercourse, blood transfusion, or from mother to child during the birthing process. Unfortunately, the risk of the chronic infection and ultimately death increases as the age of the person decreases at the time of infection. Over 90% of people, of children who are infected with this disease as an infant, go on to develop chronic infection. That is why it is given at birth. One purpose of the neonatal hepatitis B vaccine is to interrupt this transmission from mother to child and spare the child from future morbidity and mortality. Compared to the pre-vaccine era, when there were 300,000 people in the United States infected with hepatitis B, there are now 43,000 persons, and that is largely due to the hepatitis B vaccine. The hepatitis B vaccine works, and it is safe. It has been endorsed by all the leading healthcare committees, including the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, in the American Academy of Obstetrics and Gynecology. More than 100 million people in the United States have received this hepatitis B vaccine since its inception in 1982. It's gone through many changes in the recommendation of age of administration, going down to birth dose in 1989. The most common side effect is soreness, which occurs in about 25% of people, and a low-grade fever, which occurs in about 1 in 15. Serious side effects, for example, anaphylaxis or a serious allergic immune reaction occur in about 1 in 1 million. There is no scientific evidence for neurological sequela, stroke, or otherwise in patients who have received the hepatitis B vaccine. The measures proposed in House Bill 2635 present just an unnecessary obstruction towards improving the health of children. It is absolutely every person's right, and parents' right, to make an informed decision about their vaccination status of their child. That is why they're given a CDC-recommended vaccine information statement, which is written at a level on which the average parent or patient can understand. Requiring that the parent be given a copy of the full vaccine insert, which is, again, a 15-page document, seems obtrusive to me and would not be beneficial to the informed consent process. It is impracticable for parents to read this document and would unfairly discriminate against parents who, with limited English proficiency or literacy. Furthermore, no other childhood or adult vaccines required written informed consent for their administration. This requirement, as outlined in the House Bill at 2635, creates unnecessary bureaucratic paperwork and expense at a time when the goals of healthcare should be to streamline it and make it as cost-effective as possible. Both of these potential changes in Oregon law will have the undesired consequence of more unhealthy children in Oregon, and that is why I urge you to reject House Bill 2635.
Dr. Gilbert, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I need a question. Thank you. So your testimony is that the likelihood of severe symptoms is less than 1 in 1 million vaccinations. Another question that I have, are these serious side effects similar to shaken baby syndrome?
Not that I'm aware.
Okay.
Dr. Lace. Oh, I'm sorry.
Quick.
So, just go to grunt at me somehow.
Okay. Okay, Representative Cannon.
That's it. That'll work.
Okay. What you need to know. I've got three kids. They've all been vaccinated. And my pediatrician has always given me something like that. Is that a best practice, or is that?
Those are required by the, I believe by law, to be given to each parent regarding each vaccine that a parent receives.
It's not a full package insert, but does have risk information. Because, like I said, with three boys, I seem like I'm constantly at the doctor. but I recognize this format, having been through it. So this is a required by law that there is something given. Thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Yep, I heard a grunt.
Heather, also, as a parent, I'm familiar with this and other papers like it. How many languages is this available in versus how many language is the insert available in?
Off the top of my head, I do not know. I imagine that the CDC recommended vaccine information sheets are available in multiple languages. I do not think that the package insert is available in multiple languages, although I do not certain of that.
Thank you. Dr. Lace, I think this is the first time for you in this committee this year. Huh?
Yes.
The last time.
No. Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is James Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm here to testify in opposition to 2635. You've heard a lot of things, and I'm just going to reiterate just a few things. You have a handout there. That's the VIS form. That's the vaccine information form that's given to parents. I also included the package insert as it comes. This is what the package insert looks like if you've never seen one of these. It's in a little teeny print. This is actually bigger print than the one that actually in the ones that we get. But it's a fairly detailed thing, and it has a lot of things about storage of the vaccine, preparation of the vaccine. There's a little bit of information about it. But there's nowhere in here, and I looked very carefully to see if there's any mention of strokes or anything like that, and there's nothing in the package insert. So this actually wouldn't help anybody to make a decision on whether or not to do that. But, you know, this is available if somebody wants. Very difficult information to read for the average parent, since a lot of our things that we hand out to parents in routine visits when they bring their kids in for vaccines or for immunizations and for routine well-child checks, we give them a lot of materials, even though it's supposed to be paperless. I'm not sure exactly just how much is taken home. In our what we do, to give you an idea of what happens, Salem Hospital, they go through the vaccine, they offer the parent the handout, the information sheet, the VIS. The parent has to sign the vaccine. Our parents of newborns, if they have a question about the vaccine, they don't sign anything until they've had their questions answered. So we actually go through an informed consent process. We do the same thing in our office. We actually have them sign that they're getting that. We've answered their questions. They've got an issue. Let's not do it. Let's talk about it more. Come on back at another time. We don't coerce them. We don't force them. We don't do anything. We have parents that do no vaccines, some parents that do some vaccines. We just encourage them to get their children vaccinated. vaccines that we have, we've been doing hepatitis B vaccines since 1982. There's been some formulation changes. The current one is a DNA-derived vaccine. It's very, very safe. And there's no preservative in the vaccine. Any connection between the administration of the vaccine and autism, there's none that's really it's been in any statistically significant manner that's been shown to do that. Those vaccines are recorded on the patient card. They're also recorded in our electronic healthcare record system, and we also send a record to the state. If we have a vaccine reaction to any vaccine, we are supposed to report that to the VAERS system. That's the Vaccine Adverse Event Recording System that the state, the federal government has set in place. And I can tell you in the last 34 years since I've been here, I've had one reaction that could have qualified for, and we did report it to the system. It was subsequently denied, but that's the only, and that wasn't to this vaccine, it was to another vaccine. But it's a very safe vaccine. This one we don't even get any complaints about. The vaccine handout is only in English.
So,
okay. And the handout, there's multiple languages, and I think there's at least 10 different languages that the VAS thing does. So a couple of issues. We talked about prevention of cancer. That's important. There's and when you look at shaken baby syndrome, that's a problem with acceleration and deacceleration. You get, you know, basically a tearing of axonal connections. You get tearing of blood vessels in the brain. You get the retinal hemorrhages. That's a very specific thing. And it's not anywhere connected to vaccine administration. There's never been a correlation. A stroke is different than a shaken baby syndrome. It's a different mechanism. The different kind of bleeds that you get from a stroke versus shaken baby are very different. You may have, I suppose if it's really bad, you could stroke, but the bleeds that you're talking about, shaken baby, are subdurals and epidurals, but usually with a stroke, it's going to be inside the brain, and there's a specific blood vessel problem there. You've got the information there. We would encourage that we like to do the vaccine. We don't, and the cases of hepatitis B are plummeted way down. The CDC changed their whole concept about this because if they just went, initially they were just doing high risk people and said, okay, gosh, we're going to go after them. Then they said that wasn't working, that didn't make an incidence.
Actually, so you got three more hearings.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay. Including another one. You're going to
Okay, anyway, so I urge your opposition to 2635.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I call Kathleen Brady? Oh, I'm sorry.
Just for the doctor real quick. Just real quick, is there a big difference between if you did it at a two-month checkup versus doing it right after birth? Because I was looking at
The optimum timing is it's 6 months between your first one and your last one. So what we like to do is capture them at the newborn period, and for those ones, and then that there may even be at a risk of the hepatitis B coming from the mom. But then you get the other one at the six-month visit combined with all the other vaccines, then they're done for life. That's it. Otherwise, we're doing different series, and we're trying to connect them up on that. And maybe Dr. Gilbert can make another comment on that.
Yeah, just to clarify, the purpose of the vaccine at the newborn is both to prevent them from getting it if they have a sexual contact or bloodborne contact later in life, but it also prevents them if they are born and have contact with from their mother, and so that's why it's wanting to you want to give it to them within the first 12 hours of birth. In fact, in 2000, they had a momentary stoppage of giving that hepatitis B vaccine at birth and delayed it until 2 months of age, and they found kids who developed hepatitis B as a result of that missed dose. So it is strongly encouraged to give that as soon as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Catherine Brady, Ann Thomas, and Dave Barrels. I'm going to ask you to be brief, please. I think we have lots of information in front of us, so let's not belabor what we have, huh? You want to read us that?
Yes. Yeah. An empty room.
You can park with us in the snow.
Catherine, you want to start?
Sure.
For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley, Administrator of the Office of Family Health and the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I have some testimony that is being presented to you that discusses the significant public health concerns regarding House Bill 2635. Most of the issues have already been covered by the other presenters. Just a reminder that the federal requirements for the vaccine information statement started in 1994. It is in multiple languages, which you'll note in the bottom at the very back of the handout. The federal requirements do require that the provider not only document the immunization, but also the fact that they have distributed the information. So we've got federal processes in place. We've got federal requirements in place. And it will be our interpretation at this time that to put an additional burden on providers would not be something that we could support from the Public Health Division. I have Dr. Ann Thomas with me, who is an epidemiologist from our acute and chronic disease program, who could speak to incidents or any other questions you might have as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenock, I'll, I guess, keep my comments very brief unless there are more questions. Other people have already mentioned that the reason for the birth oath is to prevent perinatal transmission, and people have already speculated today about whether that occurs before birth or
during birth. I'm not sure if you mentioned your name.
I'm Dr. Ann Thomas, the Oregon Public Health Division. But studies have shown that the use of the birth dose is 95% effective in interrupting perinatal transmission, that is, spread from mother to child. So it's very effective in that manner. And before this vaccine was used universally in this way, we did identify 20 to 30 children a year in Oregon under the age of 10 who were found to be chronic carriers of hepatitis B. And although since it is asymptomatic, we feel that most of those children acquired it at birth from their mothers. And each of those children has about a 25% chance of dying from liver disease or liver cancer. Secondly, I could point out that there's sort of a value added to the birth dose of hepatitis vaccine, and that studies have shown that infants who get that first dose in the hospital, which seems to be a teachable moment, are more likely to get the second and third doses that they need in a timely fashion. In fact, because they're there at the pediatrician getting their dose at 2 and 4, 6 months, they're also more likely to get other vaccines. So interrupting the birth dose might sort of derail lower vaccination rates from other important childhood diseases. And then just lastly, we've seen that whenever recommendations have been made about specifically dropping vaccination against one vaccine, historically people have misinterpreted these. Dr. Gilbert also mentioned that there was this brief period in 2000 where we recommended stopping the birth dose because of concerns about thimerosal, and the recommendation was to not give it to children whose mothers were hepatitis B surface antigen negative, meaning the mother didn't have hepatitis B. But in fact, we found that hospitals just sort of unilaterally stopped giving the birth dose. Actually, I'll probably stop there and save your time for other questions.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. You said before the vaccine was routinely administered at birth, you had evidence of 20 to 30 children in the state of Oregon who likely received it through perinatal transmission. 20 to 30 under what age?
Under the age of 10, and that was each year.
Okay, that
so
was
so that's
mine.
20 to 30 children who each have a 25% chance of death from liver disease.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kahneman?
Do you agree with Dr. Lace that there's no evidence to suggest shaken baby syndrome is related to this?
Chair
Greenlake, I should say, excuse me.
Yeah. Chair Kinnemer,
that was poorly said, excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah, the shaken baby syndrome, it's a very controversial issue, I believe. And at this point, we've looked, we talked to the national program, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, to see if there have been any incidents of stroke, which is what Zachary was ultimately diagnosed with,
right,
not shaken baby syndrome. And since 1990, they've had 4 cases reported in 20 years. And in general, it's about roughly 4 million children born a year. So out of 80 million children, 4 cases in kids who have gotten a hepatitis B vaccine at birth. It seems quite small. It's, 1 in several million chance. And as it is, people are, providers and even parents are encouraged to report an event to the vaccine adverse event reporting system, whether they think it's linked at all, just so that, you know, the CDC can see these reports, and if there seems to be enough of a signal, then they'll do a study. And that's never been considered enough of a signal to do any study. We looked at our just Oregon reports.
Is that enough answer to you?
Is that too much numbers already?
I guess
okay.
I need to move on.
I've got more,
thank
though,
you. Yes.
If you need them, sir.
You could send it to him. That
okay.
Fine. Mr. Barrows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing Merck Pharmaceutical Corporation, one of the two manufacturers of hepatitis B vaccine. Our position, first let me say I'm very sorry about Zachary Cox. I think we all feel sad about that story. But our position is we support the federal regulations and the CDC-created vaccine information sheet, which you've seen and referenced. Two things about that I would point out. One, it has been translated into 41 languages. Number two, if you look at the second page under number 8, how can I learn more? Ask your doctor or nurse. They can give you vaccine package insert or suggest other sources of information. So parents are already being told they can receive the 13-page package insert that we prepare for our vaccine, which has been pointed out is difficult at best to read. It is prepared by this is FDA material, and it is not intended for lay people to read. It's for doctors and pharmacists and people that deal with vaccines about how to store them. It talks about studies, and unless you're into that, it really is not an informational piece that has great value to the public. So we would join others who suggest this is not a bill that should move forward at this time. We thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I just have a comment.
Comment away.
When it's appropriate. I found all this very interesting.
Hold on a minute. Why don't I dismiss the panel?
Okay.
We'll have a comment before we close the hearing.
Sure, yeah, and it's not really a question. I find this all interesting, particularly as the parent of a four-week-old. I think there is a perception out there among many that the vaccination schedule that the CDC recommends is looks the way it does as part of partly for public health strategy reasons, that these are teachable moments for young parents. And I think that's something that needs to be up front and center in our discussion of this, because the perception is it's not necessarily what's best for the kids, it's best for the public health community at large. And there is tension there, and I'm not expressing an opinion about whether, you know, we should be administering these at birth. I found compelling the statistic that their previous two administration of the vaccine, there were 20 to 30 children per year who likely received it via perinatal transmission. But I just want to, particularly for the public health folks in the room, ask them to be pretty frank about the extent to which that recommendation is, because that's a pretty captive audience, those new babies, and that's part of what's driving the desire. And I think there sounds like there are other reasons for administering this at birth, but I just want to, you know, alert folks to the fact that that is what's, I think, in part driving the skepticism around not just Hep B but others. As a personal matter, our family has chosen to slow down the vaccine schedule because it's a lot for a baby to handle, and we're quite confident we'll get there eventually. We're responsible parents. We'll do them all over time. But we are concerned enough about the many vaccines, many more than I received, and I'm not that old, but there are many more being administered to babies today. So I appreciate the ability to raise this issue if, you know, even in the context of this bill. That's it.
Getting older all the time.
No kidding.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2635 and open a public hearing. We're going to be losing some of the committee. We have a couple more to do. Let's open up a public hearing on this 3138. On 3138, I don't know whether Dr. Lace left or not. Would you describe this bill while I ask Catherine Brady and Bill Cross to come back up? And if Dr. Lace is here, he's welcome as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill was a committee bill that we introduced during the interim. It clarifies that a physician may prescribe as well as administer a vaccine to a person who
who is at least 11 years of age. It has an emergency clause and is effective on passage. Mr. Chair, just for the committee's information, we do have fiscal and revenue on this bill, and both of them are no impact.
You said clarifies that a physician may...
Pharmacist.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
It clarifies that a pharmacist may prescribe and administer vaccines.
That's right.
Okay.
Bradley?
Catherine here?
And Bill Cross.
Who's here? Oh, yeah. No, we didn't. And Bill Cross?
Yeah.
And Dr. Lace. I thought I already called you all. Dr. Lace seems to be gone. Bill, do you want to kick this off?
Certainly, sir. Mr. Committee Chair and members, my name is Bill Cross, and I am here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon State Health Systems Pharmacists. And we requested this bill after receiving contact from DHS that the Vaccinations for Children program that is federally run would not accept or that would require pharmacists to be able to prescribe vaccinations to be able to participate in that program. And as you may recall, 2 years ago, this committee approved legislation to allow pharmacists to vaccinate children 11 years and older, and we're able to go ahead and do that unless the child is a part of the VFC program. So this bill would try to narrowly alter the statute and permit or authorize pharmacists to prescribe, even though they're not really prescribing vaccinations, but this language evidently would satisfy VFC. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
It's purely a technical issue, then. This is what they're doing now?
Yes. I mean, evidently, they require all providers who vaccinate children as a part of the VFC program to have prescriptive authority. So we simply are looking for that language to be amended into the pharmacist statute. I believe you'll hear in a minute from OMA that they're kind of exploring how some of the other states have handled this, but that's all. I mean, the intent of the bill is simply to narrowly permit pharmacists to participate in the VFC program.
Well, let me try my question again.
Okay.
The bill we passed allowed pharmacists to vaccinate.
Mr. Chair, yes.
And they can do that. Is this only a technical thing that says what they're doing is prescribing and vaccinating, or is it somehow changing practice? That's the question. Catherine, do you want to try it in your testimony?
Yes.
I'll hold the question. Introduce yourself.
Co-Chairs Greenlick Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, the Administrator for the Office of Family Health and the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. In response to the question that the Representative Greenlick was raising, we are actually asking specifically for a change in the Pharmacist Practice Act, because that's actually going to enable them to be reimbursed the administrative fee for VFC programs, which means that they can administer to Medicaid. Without the change, there actually is not the ability for them to be able to administer. The Vaccine for Children's program provides vaccines at no cost for children who might otherwise not be vaccinated due to inability to pay. One of the federal requirements by CDC is that it requires pharmacists to be working in a state that has an expanded practice act that permits pharmacists to prescribe, order, and administer. What we are asking for in this case with House Bill 3138 is to very narrowly address changing the Practice Act to only allow pharmacists to prescribe immunizations. So it's just in this one narrow case. This then will enable, so it's a change, it will enable pharmacists to become VFC providers. It'll be the only way for them to immunize.
I want to try my question again, Catherine. I hate to interrupt, but I didn't ask if it was a change in the Practice Act. I asked if it was a change in the practice. Can pharmacists now basically, will this change at all what pharmacists can do in terms of giving immunization? Or does it just change the wording of it so they can get paid by this particular program? We passed a law that gave pharmacists the ability to vaccinate kids 11 and older. Does this change that? Does it expand it? Does it do anything else except,
Mr. Chair,
say we forgot to say prescribe when we said it was okay to vaccinate?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't change the original act that you passed in 2009. However, we discovered that to participate in the VFC program, we would need a technical change. But other, I mean,
I'm going to try one more time.
I get it.
I'm not asking, does it change a bill? Does it change an act? Does it change an administrative rule? Does it change anything else? I'm asking, does it change what the pharmacist legally can do? Is it expanding what we told them they could do? Jim, you want to try and answer this for me?
Okay, I'm over my head here. Would it be narrow enough, and could we do it, to say that the pharmacist may prescribe and administer VFC vaccines? If the statute said that, would that get us where we want to go? My understanding is they can do the vaccinations now. They can't get paid for having done
because
it doesn't say prescribe.
Right? A kid walks into a pharmacy now. He's 12 years old. His mother says, I want this vaccination. Does this bill change anything about what the pharmacist can do at that point except get paid?
Well, the program, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair, the program, they actually provide the vaccinations for the program. But the 12-year-old walks in, and assuming the pharmacy and pharmacists are participating in that program, they would then be able to provide that vaccination.
Well, I'm having trouble communicating my question, but I can assure you I'm not going to vote for this bill until my question gets answered. So either I have to figure out how to ask it, or somebody has to figure out how to answer it.
Mr. Chair, the pharmacist can go ahead and vaccinate. We're not, I mean, they can go ahead and vaccinate
right
11-year-olds and above.
Okay. So and all this does is change some languages somewhere. It doesn't change who they can vaccinate, how they can vaccinate them, or what they can do. It only changes whether they can get paid for it by a particular program. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay. That's what I assumed.
Chair Greenlick and Chair Thompson, so Oregon's Medicaid program, this is at the bottom of our testimony here on the first page, has a rule that requires Oregon providers to be VFC enrolled in order to be reimbursed. So this is the issue of reimbursement for the vaccination. And without narrowly redefining prescriptive authority for immunization for pharmacists, the pharmacists cannot qualify for the reimbursement.
Thank you.
We're making, I'm sorry, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. We're making Dr. Lace work very hard today, and he is down in the Senate Healthcare Committee right now testifying. So I apologize that he's not here. And I spoke with the sponsor, Co-Chair Thompson, yesterday about this bill.
And committee bill.
Yes, I apologize, you're correct. But we did speak about OMA wanting to make sure that the language is very, very ironclad, and that we're talking about that just these particular vaccines for this particular program, and we're working on with Mr. Cross on figuring out that language, and we think we'll be there shortly.
Amendment coming.
Yeah.
You helping?
I'm more direct than her. One of the problems is the word prescribe. It makes doctors feel very uncomfortable.
I understand.
So we're trying to craft language so the word prescribe is zeroed in on this group of vaccines because of the reimbursement program that backs them up. And in order to get into that program, correct me if I'm wrong, they have to be able to prescribe the vaccine they give in the program. Mm-hmm. Our law does not say they prescribe it. It says they administer it.
I'm curious a little bit to hear a little bit more about that discomfort. Which vaccines that a pharmacist might administer to a child above 11 years old are doctors nervous about allowing them to prescribe.
No. The word prescribe. I didn't mean vaccines. Prescribing is something traditionally done by a physician. Administering is done by nurses or pharmacists, whatnot. When we change this law, we put the word prescribe in a pharmacist language. That makes the word prescribe for in any context makes doctors a little nervous.
Okay, I repeat my question. Yeah. Why are doctors nervous about allowing pharmacists to prescribe and administer vaccines to persons who are over 11 years old?
Yeah.
And Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, we want these children to be vaccinated, and if they choose to do that at a pharmacy with a pharmacist, that is fine. We worked with Representative Thompson on the bill last session that did this, and we have no problem with that. We have no problem with the vaccines that are part of the via the program. But as you said, you are opening, you're expanding the scope almost by saying that they can prescribe. And so we just want to make sure that that's narrow and it's appropriate.
I'm not satisfied with that answer because I feel like there's something that isn't being said.
Not really.
I think what you see is what you get.
Well, it doesn't seem well justified, given that this bill would merely, I understand you want an amendment that would clarify this is only vaccines that are part of the program. So what would that amendment satisfy? Are there categories of vaccines out there that we really don't want to see pharmacists prescribe?
No, the other issue is that this is a federal guideline that Oregon is trying to match, and there are other states going through the same process. So we're trying to make sure that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So we're looking at our other state, our other colleagues, and how they are handling this issue too.
You would be happy with language that only said pharmacists can prescribe and administer vaccines. That wouldn't make you unhappy. I think that's the question that's being asked.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The current language says administer vaccines, adding prescribe and administer vaccines.
That's all it's doing. I think Representative Thompson proposed language around a particular set of vaccines. That's not what they're trying to do, I think. They're just trying to limit it to vaccines, right?
No.
No.
They won't limit it further.
We're not limiting what they can prescribe or can vaccinate now. That's already in federal. Yeah. That's already part of the program. We're not saying one vaccine over another. That's already in the program.
You're just letting them prescribe vaccines that they can now administer.
Correct.
Does that get you there? We're both having trouble with questions today. I think it's late. I think I'm going to close this hearing.
We could also change the federal law
and
to take that requirement out, but it's easier to change this one.
I'm going to close this hearing, and we'll get it back again when we get some amendment. Then we can ask our question once again.
I'd love to try and do an easy one.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2068, and ask Marie Felton and Deborah.
No, that's Lori's on behalf of Deborah.
Okay. Is that Lori? Oh, Marie. Okay. Marie Felton, please. And will you tell us what we're about, Madam Administrator?
I'll try and do my best to explain, Mr. Chair.
Before I lose it completely.
Right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HB 2068 comes to you at the request of the State Board of Psychologist Examiners. This is asking, we passed a bill last session that increased their civil penalties. There was one area in statute that was missed with that new language. This bill does rectify that over what we overlooked last time.
And there's a subsequent?
Yeah, to judiciary.
Okay.
And I do...
You make it brief and we still have a quorum and it's only going to judiciary, we might actually move it to that.
I'll skip. Chair Greenlich and Chair Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Lori Felton and I'm here on behalf of our Executive Director, Deborah McHugh, who is unable to come today. The bill before you is an effort by the board to correct inconsistent language in our statute. Last session, Senate Bill 174 was heard and passed by the legislature and authorized the board to level a civil penalty up to $10,000 in specific disciplinary situations. We later discovered that there was a second mention in the statute regarding the amount of the civil penalty authority.
Currently, our statute states authority for a civil penalty of $1,000, and other sections states authority for civil penalty up to $10,000. The bill today before you will correct the inconsistent language. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
I like this one.
You like this one? Okay. If you like this one, I'll close the hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 2068 and accept a motion to send this bill on to the Judiciary Committee if somebody's ready to make one.
Should we look in the hall, possibly?
See if anybody's hanging out there?
Yeah.
Like Bill? Yeah. We'll stand at ease for a moment.
Either he doesn't like it.
Okay. I have opened a work session. We'll come back to order. I've opened a work session, and I am ready to accept an amendment. I mean, a proposal motion to move.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
May I make a motion that we move House Bill 2068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Judiciary?
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. Representative Widener, any discussion? Okay. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Boyle?
Excused.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kennemer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
Oh. Bill? But you just identified that Representative Doherty is excused also.
Oh, yeah, yes, you didn't call Doherty, right?
Representative Doherty.
She's excused also. I'm not feeling well today. Motion passes, and I'll close the public hearing on the work session on House Bill 2068 and open up a hearing on a brief bill. Hearing on House Bill 3019. And what do we have on 3019?
Bill Carson, Jim.
Thank you very much. Bill, still here?
And Jonathan Thompson.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Thompson.
While they're coming up, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make, I don't want to put any pressure on the committee, but this bill comes to us from my daughter-in-law. And the amount of time I get to spend with my two-year-old granddaughter is dependent on what this committee does with this bill. So no pressure from here, you know. Whatever, you know.
Too bad we didn't schedule the work session.
Vote your conscience on this one.
Aye.
Please.
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Thompson. I'm the caucus administrator for the Senate Republicans, and I live in Kaiser. But today I'm here representing my wife, Dr. Jennifer Frankel, who is a dentist here in Salem. The genesis of this bill started last summer when my wife was in between jobs and volunteered at the dental clinic for the Boys and Girls Club here in Salem. They have a wonderful facility, and they staff it with strictly volunteer dentists. She ran into a problem when she first started there in the fact that because she was in between jobs, she had no medical malpractice insurance, which she needed to volunteer. So we went out and we bought malpractice insurance on the open market, which, you know, when you're buying it as an individual, we can all understand how that could get pricey fast, and it does. But we bought medical malpractice insurance, and she went on to volunteer. Since that time, she has received calls from several other dentists around the Salem area who wanted to volunteer and were asking, how did you get around the medical malpractice issue? And she told them, I went out and bought it. And if this bill, if passed, would allow dentists like my wife to do that volunteer work, but it would also apply to other providers, such as maybe a retired physician who wanted to volunteer in a free clinic. They would still be a licensed physician and they would in good standing with their board, but they would not have to go out and purchase malpractice insurance. So this bill would help those wishing to volunteer. It would help them serve more people, and
it wouldn't cost anything for the state. So, and just as a side note, as we were getting ready for this hearing, got a couple of calls from some other healthcare providers in the Salem area who had run into similar situations. There are some, like for example, the Northwest Medical Team's dental van. There are some providers who volunteer on that van. They get children or indigent adults who can't. Who can't afford treatment, but the treatment they need is more than can be done on the dental van. So they do open up their offices to do this treatment, but while they have these offices open, they have the same issue with liability insurance. So you have providers who are willing to do some of this work at no cost, but they run into problems with malpractice insurance. So anyway, that's the bill, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. You have. We'll get back to questions in a minute.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. We support the bill. We had introduced or requested the committee to introduce another bill to add optometric physicians and pharmacists to the list of about a half a dozen medical providers who currently have liability when working with charitable organizations for no fee, and because pharmacists are now involved in vaccination clinics in many cases without a fee, or working optometrists with the Lions Club or schools on screenings there again without a fee. We were looking for some relief, and this bill would actually suffice for the other legislation that we were requesting to be introduced.
You don't need an amendment to this bill?
No. It's broad enough that it would take in, I think, all the health care providers.
Other questions?
Yes. It would appear, thank you, Mr. Chair, it would appear that that charitable organizations already do enjoy immunity under current law, and this bill proposes to change the definition or the reference in statute to charitable organizations.
My understanding, and I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding, and I'm a little hazy on the definition between a charitable corporation and a charitable organization, but I think I think where we get hung up is the different definition between a charitable corporation and a charitable organization. This would allow charitable organizations such as the Boys and Girls Club, for example, to dentist to volunteer at places like that. So,
okay, I will be interested in. I know, maybe it's just research I'll do, but if there's anything the committee can receive on the difference between the original, the existing reference to the proposed new reference, that would be helpful.
Can you follow up some more? Ben?
Nope.
Representative Widener?
This is going to scare Bill and Jonathan, but what if we also included doctors and people taking in the Oregon Health Plan, because that's almost charitable with our reimbursement rates being so late, so in Medicaid. Sorry, with that broad relating to clause. You might get some people here in opposition, attorneys.
I wondered why there was no one here. Now,
have you had, devil's workshop. That was my question. Have you had any opposition to this? I mean, have you heard from the trial lawyers or anybody else that are worried about it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no one's come forward to me, but I don't know that they would, so I can't really answer that question.
Mr. Chair, there is another bill that the Lions Club has introduced. It's in the House Judiciary, and they've been talking about the organization and its liability, and I know the trial attorneys have been monitoring it. I think, and I cannot obviously speak for them, but based on amendments I've seen for that bill, they seem comfortable or aren't involved in if we continue to have the reference to liability, this would not apply if gross negligence or that standard
of course,
is
yeah,
met. Right. So I think they're, as I said, I don't want to speak for them, but that may be why they're not here today.
Well, what I would suggest we do, as soon as we can schedule a work session, particularly if there's no opposition, we might ask LC to come and discuss that particular issue with us and It sounds like that's it.
Was that Medicare? Write a memo. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask that for them to write a memo to
Medicaid? Is that the issue?
No, that's not the issue.
I just thought we should have some fun. I mean, that's the, you know, we've been looking to cut down the cost of health care.
That would solve the malpractice problem.
That would do it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
With all due respect.
Well, thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3019, and we'll schedule that for a work session as soon as we can. And we'll ask LC to send us a memo on that.
And then we see if they want to come and just outline it for us at our work session.
That'd be great. And we'll force Representative Thompson to carry it on the floor so he can redeem himself with his...
I've got a 3x4 foot portrait of my granddaughter I can use as a... What do you have to ask for using props or whatever? I can...
Visual aid,
yeah. He's got visual aid.
We are adjourned. We made it.
4, 5, 9.